Described in the New York Times as a gorgeously tight tale, One of the Boys is a debut novel that leads us on sort of a traumatic road trip for a 12-year-old with his wayward father and older brother. Kansas City native Daniel McGarriel learned a lot about transforming life into art with the writing of this book.
You know, fiction is not real life, and a lot of it doesn't even attempt to replicate real life. This is realistic realism that we're messing with here, but it's focused.
Listen to what else Daniel McGarriel discovered about the craft from his mentor, the award-winning fiction writer George Saunders, leading to this book that sold in 15 countries and on its way to becoming an independent film. One of the Boys by Daniel McGarriel, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Daniel McGarriel began his writing life when he was about 10 or 11 with the publication of one of his poems in an anthology. He's also experimented with long-form journalism, but fiction has won him over, as you'll hear in this 2017 interview recorded right after Scribner released this first novel. Though he now lives in New York City, he returns to Kansas in the setting of this book that then takes us to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where a new and rather dangerous life begins for the two brothers with their single father after a custody fight. I want to warn you that the first reading from this book, about 5.5 minutes from now, contains some language and a description of corporal punishment that may not be for all ears. But first, here's Daniel McGarriel on how One of the Boys came to be.
So I was a senior at Columbia in New York, and I used to go to this coffee shop. And while I was there, I just came in contact with these great New York writers who just all seemed to congregate in this very special place. It became my movable feast watching these wonderful writers work.
Nathan Englander was one of
and Rivka Gauchin and Julie Otsuka, who was a finalist for the National Book Award a few years ago with Boot in the Attic. I would just sit there and try to write a short story, try to see what came out. And then I graduated, moved to Colorado, and I'm going to sit in Denver and I'm going to write a novel.
By that time, you had decided you wanted to do a novel.
To be honest, I thought it was going to be linked stories. I didn't know what I was doing. It's just fumbling in the dark, hoping my next step would be on the solid ground.
Well, I was really intrigued by this because I know that you had some addiction in your family, and you have been brave enough to admit that you've got some things about your own life in here, which I think every writer does. But for you, it's been very conscious, but you fictionalize this too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot in here that is totally made up. I read a quote by you that said, "My job as a fiction writer is curating, organizing, cutting, exaggerating, and escalating fact," which I thought was a wonderful description of what a fiction writer does.
The real premise of the book for me when I first started was this notion where, okay, when I was a young child, my brother and I and my sister, we all came to realize that our father was doing drugs. And how did we come to learn that? The closed doors, the smells, the erratic behavior, the nocturnal lifestyle.
Which you capture in this book.
And
very
it felt
well.
Like a thank you. It felt like a fertile world to play with.
Early on, when you were only 23, you worked for an at-risk center in the Rockies for young people. And I couldn't help but think, after I had finished your novel, One of the Boys, that you could have also used some of the stuff from there, because these boys are at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And here, the two brothers are definitely at risk. Did you find that was helpful in telling the story that had not only to do with you, but did that give you distance?
It did. When I graduated from my undergraduate, it was June of 2008, and the Great Recession just smacked us all in the face. And so I moved across country to Denver, where my brother lived, looking for work, and I couldn't find a job. Here I am, an enthusiastic, excited. I got an Ivy League degree. I'm thinking I'm going to take on the world. And I found a job that paid me $10 an hour working at a treatment center for at-risk youth. And about 2 months later, even though I had no social work experience, you know, I didn't understand the psychology, the mental health aspects, even the educational, because there was a school in the facility as well. They promoted me to be a supervisor because I could relate to the kids in some ways. And so I would absolutely say that my experience working with these at-risk youth, who were around the same age as the boys in the novel, the experience was uncannily helpful. And one of the reasons, more than any, is, and this was only really discovered in the act of writing again, where there are these moments where maybe a flashback comes for these boys, and they think about what life had been back in Kansas before they relocated with their father to New Mexico. This flashback, I'm thinking of one in particular in the middle of the book that just smacks the narrator right in the face. And he's looking at this woman who has mascara running down her cheeks, and he's reminded of this traumatic moment with his mother. In composing that single moment, those few sentences, that transition from mascara on stranger to traumatic memory of mom, I realized that these children were suffering from some form of PTSD. And that is something I saw on a daily basis at this treatment center for at-risk youth. And it was a hard thing to look away from when you saw these kids and the horrible experiences they've had, far worse than the kids suffer in this novel. Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking. But they were all suffering from some form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
I'm talking today with Daniel McGarriel, who's the author of One of the Boys. It involves two parents who are addicted, and the family falls apart. The father, when the book opens up, he hasn't been physically violent with the sons, but he has been with the mother. Then once they take off and make their trip west to New Mexico from Kansas, then he starts releasing on them. I think I'm going to have you start with one of the passages that is so hard to endure, and this is from chapter 3. This was the first time that I really winced.
When I was working on this book, I knew that early on, some act of violence needed to happen so that the reader would understand what was at stake constantly whenever the father was in the room with his children. And so this is that scene. The narrator has already been in trouble once at his new school, and the father has told him not to get in trouble again. The next week, the principal called again. I'd been in a fight. I hadn't been the aggressor, but in her opinion, I had provoked the altercation. I'd challenged one of the better basketball players to a game during lunch and beat him bad. Then he hit me in the stomach. I was new, the principal told my father, so she was concerned. Another fight, and she would have to suspend me. For now, she wanted him to pick me up. He refused. I sat in the office until the end of the day. I used the secretary's phone to leave a message at my brother's school for him to meet me after he got out. That way, no one would mess with me on my walk home. When the bell rang, he was there, waiting. "Does Dad know?" my brother asked. I nodded. "You think he'll be mad?" "Your first fight, son," he impersonated our father. "You're not a child anymore. Welcome to manhood. You carry your own sins now." "Double digits," I said, taking a turn, mimicking a talk he'd given me 2 years ago on my 10th birthday. "No one in our family has ever made it to triple digits." 6 feet tall," my brother went next. "Congratulations. You're growing up so fast. You know, no one in our family has ever made it to 7 feet." "Or died a virgin," I tried. "You might," he said. We laughed. Our dad was standing at the top of the stairs when we got home. He halted my brother with his hand. "Inside," he said to me. He ushered me into the apartment, closed the door, flicked the deadbolt. He snatched me by the neck. My body braced in fear. I fought him as he dragged me to the bathroom, where he showed me myself in the mirror. "What the f*** is the matter with you?" he hissed. He stripped his belt from the belt loops, whipped it back. After the first lash, I knew my father had hit me with the buckle. After the second, my hand having reached around to block the blow, pain ripped from my finger, up my arm, into my neck. He dropped the belt, wrapped both hands around my throat, my chin tucked. Drool swung from my lip. Tears and snot ran into my mouth. He held me inches from my own reflection, threatened to smash my face. I put my hands up to the mirror to brace myself in case he tried. One of my fingernails was missing. The buckle had popped it right off. "How am I supposed to control you?" he whispered angrily into my ear. "Tell me, is this what I have to do to get your attention? Is this how I have to do it?" My father snarled at me through the mirror. his hot breath and wet words streaming into my ear. Then he pushed me to the floor, left me panting by the bathtub. I was horrified and confused. I'd seen him whip my mother before with a belt. In fact, there were times when she was so terrorized by him that she would just give up, her entire being, like there was nothing left of her but a plea for mercy. She'd have apologized for the weather if it would have ended his rampage a second sooner. The difference was, she deserved it. What I had done paled in comparison. During their marriage, she was always losing her jobs. Each new one would last a month or so before she started faking sick days without my father knowing. It infuriated him more and more every time she got fired. She pissed us kids off, too. After the separation, she stayed in bed all day, forgot to pay the electric bill, neglected to pick us up from school. Nights we stayed with her, my brother and I were lucky to find food in the fridge. I understood my father's frustrations with her. I shared them. Never before, though, had he handled either of us boys so violently. Until now, his brutality had been reserved for her.
Daniel McGarriel. This is New Letters on the Air, and his debut novel is called One of the Boys.
You know, I learned a valuable lesson from J.P. Dunleavy's The Ginger Man. I had read it a few years before, and in the opening chapter, he hits his wife, and he never does it again. But because it happened so early, the threat of violence exists throughout, and the reader feels that. The writer kind of gets credit for like two simultaneous things happening. One, the hit, which never happens, but the reader feels like it's going
you
to.
You imagine it, yeah, because it's happened before.
Exactly. And two, the reprieve, the gift that he doesn't.
One of the Boys, it's told from the viewpoint of a 12-year-old boy whose name we never really get. Oddly enough, you would think I would think, what is his name? But it didn't seem to be important. That was an interesting choice you made. Why did you make that choice?
Well, I think initially because I was sort of learning to write fiction through personal experience. One of the questions I asked myself early on was, what is sort of a natural short story from my own life to begin with?
And so, that's what you wanted to write in the beginning, a short story?
Yeah, well, I wanted to write fiction, but how do I start writing fiction?
Well, write what you know.
Write what you know.
Right.
And so you start to discover all these other aspects to writing that sort of help you distance yourself from your own experiences and helps you actually lock in on what's happening on the page and get you excited about the act of creating. And so I started off with this notion, well, let's try to write a short story. All right, what do I know? Well, here's an episode from when I was younger. Let's see how it looks when I start to put it down. Well, initially, there was a name for the narrator, and there were names, and I was sort of pulling them out of a hat. And every time I put a new name on any of these characters, because it's not just the narrator who's unnamed, it's the brother who's unnamed, the father who's unnamed, and the mother, so the nuclear family, whereas everyone on the periphery
has a name. Right.
And so at first, it was just every time I put a name on any of these characters, it just felt fake. So the suspicion of disbelief just collapsed for me as the writer. And so I just decided to try it without names as I worked my way into it. So then one short story turns into two short stories. They get shelved for a long time. And then I start to write this book at the beginning. And eventually these two short stories become chapter 5 and chapter 6. And they change dramatically in order to fit into a longer narrative. But what I came to realize as I started to stack these chapters next to each other was that the namelessness took on a universality to it, and it had a certain power. And so what started off as sort of like me just trying to trick myself into continuing to work to write a novel became something much more powerful. And in that way, I learned a valuable lesson just about how writers interact with their work, and that is to see it with fresh eyes is a very difficult thing to do, but it's always something that I think good writers hunt for.
I read that chapters 5 and 6 were what you decided to submit when you wanted to get into graduate school at Syracuse mm-hmm. in New York, where the wonderful George Saunders teaches.
I was able to finish drafts of these two short stories, and I decided I wanted to go to get my MFA, and I applied. So it's a very small program. There are 600 applicants. They accept 6 of us. We get to be there for 3 years, fully funded. And the third year, 6 fiction writers, we 6 get to work with George Saunders in a workshop. And I turned in my first workshop, a chapter of this big sprawling militia novel. Oklahoma City, guns, you know, references to all the domestic terrorism happening at the time in the mid-90s. And he read the first chapter and he's like, well, it's okay.
He wasn't excited.
But those submission stories from 3 years ago, I still remember them. What are you doing with those? He just sort of gently guided me back to that. And I just started with chapter one. And then 3 years later, I have a book.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
and it was just that sort of subtle and gentle guidance and encouragement. And so I wrote the first chapter in like 2 weeks. And I put it on his desk. And he went nuts for it. He's just like, okay, do it 15 more times. I did it 10, but it worked. So
that's wonderful. Well, there's something about his work that I think he probably could see in your work, which is no matter how awful the characters can be, he as a writer has great compassion for the people in his books. And I feel that you have that as well, because there are some things that happen in here that are just terrible, and yet you never hate the people. I think that's a gift to be able to make a reader feel that kind of compassion for characters as well.
Well, that sort of comparison to George Saunders is just about the nicest thing anyone ever said to me, because when I finish a George Saunders story, I feel like my heart is a little bit bigger. I feel like all of his characters, and maybe this is true to life, are sort of fumbling their way towards enlightenment somehow.
That's a good way to describe it, fumbling your way to enlightenment.
And something Harry Cruse also once wrote, he said, fiction is people doing things to and with each other all according to their own best lights. And in George Saunders' work, those lights are pretty bright, even if there's a lot of muck around them as well.
Is it true that you used to write poetry? Do you still write poetry?
I don't, but I hope that I put enough tension on the sentences where the specificity and clarity and occasionally a bit of beauty comes in. And I think those are sort of the tenets that poetry taught me. I used to write poetry as a cathartic outlet when I was younger, and I continued to love it and write it as I got older. And then I decided that you couldn't make money off of poetry, so I stopped. So for a period of time, I was like, I'm going to be a nonfiction writer. I'm going to do journalism, long-form journalism. And then I didn't have the heart for it, and I found my way to fiction.
Interesting.
But I think it was Faulkner said that short story writers are failed poets. And novelists are failed short story writers. So the food chain of, you know, the literary world, poets are, they're the kings and queens.
I love that. I'm talking today with Daniel McGarriel, the author of One of the Boys, that happens to be his debut novel, and you're listening to New Letters on the Air. Well, let's have you read a passage in here. This actually comes from the end of chapter 4. So you might set up what's going on with the coach.
At this point in the book, the father's addiction is getting worse, and he's starting to encroach on the lives of the boys. And
we should say he's addicted to coke and crack.
And he is acting erratic, and his boys are starting to recognize his patterns of behavior. But the older brother is a really talented basketball player, and it is sort of one of the few outlets that either of these children have outside of home. And the father's asking the older brother to stay home more and more often in order to help him catch up with his work, his business.
And so he's missing school, and he's missing basketball practice.
And he's earning the ire of Coach Baez. And in this moment, the father is trying to apologize to get more playing time for the older brother because of something that the father has done to sort of sabotage his relationship with the coach. The team came out of the locker room. Coach Baez walked right past my father, ignored him when he asked for a word in private. My father grabbed his shoulder. Baez pointed a finger in my father's face, then went to walk away. My father shoved him from behind. The whole team watched as Baez slammed into the bleachers, pushed back off, turned, and punched my father in the nose. He fell on his ass. His legs splayed out in front of him. He looked around the gymnasium, stunned, an infant about to bawl, bleeding all over his shirt. I waited for my father to stand so as not to embarrass him further. I followed him to the bathroom, helped clean him up. At home, the lower rims of his eye sockets bruised. My father told my brother that there was still hope. After today, though, he would have to transfer. My brother had no other choice, my father explained. I grabbed the brochure from the Rio Rancho development, took the opportunity to sell him on the move. I pointed out the model home we liked, told him about the amenities we could choose from. I even mentioned the morning deck, the one that faced the mountains, the sunrise. Let me call Rio Rancho's coach, my father said. Just give me the go-ahead. My brother got up, went to our room without saying a word. In bed that night, I asked him what he thought about the house and the brochure. We couldn't afford any of that shit, dumbass. Fine, I fired back. Then what are you going to do about Baez? He ignored me. Your coach hit Dad in the face, I said. Aren't you going to do anything? The next day, he quit the team. Out in the park on Sunday, my brother lowered his shoulder into my chest, knocked me to the ground, went in for a layup. My father, per usual, said nothing. On my first possession, I pulled up for a jump shot. My brother flicked me in the balls. I called a foul. No fouls, my brother said. My father kept silent. My brother grinned at us both. He didn't care about what was fair. He was making his own rules to his own game. He was going after me to get back at our dad. Maybe he was angry with me, too. He took the ball, ran me over a second time, but rather than score a basket, he dribbled back out to the three-point line, waited for me to get up. I got up. He knocked me to the ground again, and again I was up, my elbows and palms scraped raw. It didn't matter why my father was not intervening. I didn't want him to anymore. And it wasn't about Rio Rancho, either. I was done being ignored, pushed around. I'd only tried to do right by the two of them, and I was getting bullied for it. My brother came at me once more, shoulder lowered. This time, I was ready. I sidestepped, stuck my leg out to trip him. This is what you get, I thought. Both of you. You can hurt me, but I can hurt you too. My brother hopped over my foolish leg, drove to the hole, laid the ball softly into the net. He was such a beautiful basketball player. It was a marvel to watch him move. My father sat us down for another of his family meetings later that day. Listen, he said, I'm not proud of how I've treated you boys since we've been here. I've been inconsistent. I've made mistakes. We came here together, each of our own volition, for our own reasons, to start a new life. It hasn't been easy, true. As the father, that makes me the leader. So some of it's my fault. He looked to my brother. If it's important to you to stay at your school, I understand. But are you sure that's what you want? My brother lied, said he didn't care about basketball. He just didn't want to move again. I respect that. Lord knows my father moved us around to a new school every year. There is virtue in sticking it out, in staying put, in building the stamina necessary to endure anything. We can take it. Can't we take it? Can't we? We nodded. Good. There's something else I want to say. Me and my little brother, Donnie, your Uncle Don, we were never close. We were 8 years apart. He was my father's favorite. I was my mom's. Anyway, I never wanted that for you. That's why I had you boys 2 years apart. It was my idea to have both of you, you know? Well, actually, he said to my brother, your mother must have been putting the birth control up the wrong hole with you. He waited for us to smile at his joke. He turned to me. But you were my idea. You wouldn't exist without me. You boys, you're so close in age. You're supposed to be there for each other. You're supposed to stand up for each other no matter what. You understand, don't you? Don't you? Don't look at me. What are you looking at me for? Look at your brother. Look at your brother, damn it. We turned to each other. This is your brother for life. You are his last line of defense.
That was a bit from One of the Boys by Daniel McGarriel. And this is New Letters on the Air. And I think it really enforces the father wanting to do right by his boys. But, you know, he does such awful things to them along the way.
Yeah, I think what's illustrative about the father, at least in that section, is that, I mean, one of the reasons the older brother gets benched initially is because he's not showing up to practice this because he's helping the father. And instead of the father taking the responsibility on himself, he transfers it
yes.
to the coach. And similarly, I think when the father sees his two sons sort of going at it on the basketball court, he recognizes that something is not right. And instead of being like, you know, and he does mention, well, some of it's my fault. But he's also putting on airs, I think, in that moment. And he wants to take on the role of good father. And what's amazing is that in that moment, and the father does have these moments where all of a sudden his humanity is laid bare, despite some of the horrifying things he does to his kids, where these little nuggets of wisdom arrive. And that's a moment, I think, that teaches the boys how to survive him by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to protect each other, they're going to have to break away from the father. And he teaches them that without realizing
his own undoing in some ways.
Correct.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I know that your parents are both alive. What's it like for your family? Because a lot of times a book like this will come out after a family member has died, but that's not the case for you. So what kind of reaction have you gotten from your own family?
Well, I think that everyone in my nuclear family who's read it, my brother, my sister,
Who is not in the book,
and my mother and my father, they're all, I think, mostly amazed at how the feel of it is right, but the details are all completely, like we said, escalated, exaggerated, curated. That said, it's those people who I know sort of like one degree away from, you know, like, oh, yeah, of course, I know that family. Oh, he wrote a book. Oh, can you believe that dad is such an incorrigible, horrible, you know, addict? Well, no. You know, my dad is not that man. And that mother, she left those kids. She abandoned them. She never showed up to save them. Well, my mom's very sweet. She's like, wonderful. That never happened, you know? So like the parents get a bad rap. And then they probably read like, man, that older brother, he really took a lot on. The maturity of such a young man to sort of rise to the occasion. Well, no, my brother was a jerk growing up. And now he's a responsible, kind, compassionate human being. But all of these features, they serve the narrative. They need to be sort of these extreme versions because I think that's, in a lot of ways, the playground of fiction. The psychological weight of this book really rests on the narrator and how he takes on some of the bad things he's been asked to do and how he's wrestling with the seduction of this toxic masculinity that the father creates within the confines of this very claustrophobic apartment and his own guilt, his own remorse, and to realize what kind of man do I want to be. And 13-year-olds aren't really faced with that. And they're certainly not thinking about it as coherently as this boy is sometimes. All fiction is, even realistic fiction, is still just these sort of life experiments, this sort of play.
It's got the same kind of power to it as that other coming-of-age story by Wolfe.
Tobias Wolfe.
Yeah, this Tobias Wolfe. Yeah. I mean, they're very different stories and very different ways of writing, but still, it packs that kind of punch that book did,
I thought. I'll say is an extraordinary compliment, especially because he is a Syracuse guy. And he was actually George Saunders' mentor at Syracuse.
That's great.
It's a pretty...
So you're the grandson.
We're leaping forward way too far. I might be on the kiddie side of the pool, but it's great to tread in the same water.
Daniel McGarriel and his novel, One of the Boys, published in 2017 by Scribner and now out in paperback. McGarriel goes to Rome in fall 2018 to work on the screenplay for award-winning Iranian director-producer Babak Jalali. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Ashley Coates, Cedric Hurt, and Jamie Walsh. For more, visit newletters.org. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.